Accession number 4550, real one.
General Breeden, real one. Could you tell me something, first of all, General Breeden, about your family and educational background?
Well, I suppose you could say that I come of a professional army family. My father and grandfather were both regulars. The Battle of Agincourt, where we had ancestors who fought on both sides. I have a brother, too, who went into the army, and he did quite well. And I haven't, in fact, got any sons of my own, but my brother has, and his son is now a captain in the regular army. So you could say that we are an old-fashioned, I suppose you could say, regular army family who originated from the south of Ireland, one of the Protestant minority in the south of Ireland, and who've been in the army for many, many years.
Where were you educated?
I was educated at King's School, Canterbury, where my father had been educated as well, and which I think made quite an effect on me, because you can't go to school under that lovely cathedral for whatever it was number of years without something of the atmosphere there permeating you.
And did you go to Sandhurst?
And I went to Sandhurst, where I passed in fairly low, I think, but I passed out quite high. How, why, I'm not really very sure, but I liked Sandhurst. There are a number of people, and there have been one or two plays and so forth made recently by people who, obviously, Sandhurst had not suited, and who proceed to give their own particular little story, which I think is usually a very much a minority story, trying to make out that Sandhurst was brutal and bad few and undemocratic and so forth. The fact of the matter was that it suited probably 95% of the people who went to it, and the other ones, well, when the kitchen gets too hot, you have to get out of it, or you should get out of it. And they're complaining because Sandhurst didn't suit them. But for the rest of us, it was a marvellous training ground for the army and for life, where you were taught quite firmly that orders were to be obeyed, and that you had to be very fit and very tough and get a move on. It was good training.
Which regiment did you go into?
I went into the Ulster Rifles. You may well say, why the Ulster Rifles? And the reason really is that my father was in the Indian Army, because he found that he couldn't afford to serve in the British Army, and you got much better pay in the Indian Army in those days. But two of his brothers had been in the Royal Irish Regiment, which was one of those regiments which was disbanded in 1921. And as that regiment had been disbanded, he opted for what he reckoned was the next best thing, which was one of the three Irish regiments still left in the British Army, in which he had a friend, in fact, General Gartland, who he'd known in Burma. And so I went into the Ulster Rifles, and I have never regretted the choice.
Which year was this that you went into the regiment?
That was in January 1936. I went into the regiment. I joined them at Gravesend, and within 18 months or so, we were off to Palestine. And so I had what you might call about 18 months peacetime service after I joined from Sandhurst. And then, from then on, it was either service in Palestine or, with a very short gap of a few months, the Second World War.
What was your reaction when you heard that you were going to Palestine?
Oh, we were delighted. I mean, for young people like myself, I was 19 when I joined the regiment. I was 20 when we heard the news, and this meant foreign service, a little bit of chance of excitement and action. We didn't know there was going to be action. We knew there'd been a rebellion there in 1936, but at this particular time there were rumblings, but nothing very much happening. Things started happening almost as we arrived in Palestine.
Were you briefed about the situation in Palestine before you went?
Oh, yes. We were told very much. We were told a lot about the kind of historical background. We were not only back in barracks in Katrik, but also in the troop ship on the way to Palestine, which was a very good time to do it. We were told all about things like the Balfour Declaration, and indeed we read up the Palestine campaigns of Allenby in the First War, and we were told quite a lot about Arabs and Jews and what they did and where they lived, and of course we were given maps and told to study them, and we were pretty well briefed on the political and military background. The thing that was completely new to us, and which you can't really get briefed about, was the climate and the people and the smells, and all of which greeted us when we landed in Haifa. And I'll never forget the marvelous sort of warmth and sunshine and curious foreign, as they were to us, smells which greeted us.
And were you told anything about the way in which to approach the local population, what to do and what not to do?
Well, naturally enough, we were told that basically at that particular time it was likely that the Arab would be the enemy, and that the Jew would probably be more or less on our side, for the simple reason that the trouble had arisen because the Arabs were angry that not only were the Jews buying a lot of their land, but also that the Arabs suspected that too many Jews were being allowed to come into Palestine. The real problem of illegal immigration hadn't, as far as we knew, started, but obviously the Arabs reckoned that it was going on. And so it was the Arabs complaining that their country was being taken over by the Jews. In many ways, we felt a bit sympathetic towards the Arabs. But on the other hand, we knew that we were told that any Arab village was a place that might harbour people who would actively resist the army. We didn't actually know when we got to Palestine to what extent we would be involved. We knew we were being sent there as a precaution in case more troops were needed. Obviously, the government knew more than we did about the future trends.
Were you warned about Arab customs and how you might cause offence if
yes.
you...
Yes, we were told all the sort of things like the Arabs don't like soldiers wearing too few clothes, and they particularly don't like women to go around unless they've got long garments and they're practically shielded up to the eyes. And we were told quite a few things about those aspects, and of course that we must completely respect places like mosques and any Muslim shrines. And in fact, we were told quite a lot about the Arab customs and what to do and what not to do. I found, by and large, that during those days and later, we were quite good about telling British troops what the local customs were and what to respect. We didn't visualize actually sort of mixing a great deal with the Arabs, and in fact, except for normal relations when we were going into villages or staying in villages, we would drink lots and lots of cups of coffee with them. But of course, the language barrier came between us, so you can say that here and there, where we were lucky, we had a company commander in my regiment who had spent 3 or 4 years in the Sudan and spoke Arabic well, so he was able to get on with the Arabs when we were in one of their villages. But by and large, most of us didn't have a great deal to do with the Arabs, and we were usually not stationed in or near a town.
You just said that you warned your men about Arab customs, but did you brief your men about the reason why they were there in Palestine in the same way that you'd been briefed by your senior officers?
Yes, though probably in a slightly more simple form. The sort of briefing that we would give them would be, look, here is a country where there is likely to be trouble. The trouble is likely to be caused by the Arabs because they think their country is being taken over by the Jews. Therefore, the Jews are likely to be friendly to us and the Arabs are likely to be hostile. If trouble comes, it will probably mean that the battalion will be split up into company groups and we shall operate as a column to try and find any of the terrorists who we knew from experience tended to melt away and hide their rifles under rocks until they got a fairly soft target of only a few men rather than a column. We briefed ourselves in general of the generalities of what is likely to happen. We also briefed them to expect a lot of climbing on up rocky hills, to learn to do with drinking the minimum of water, and that it was going to be jolly hot. We briefed them on other quite important little things about not taking off their shirts for too long and too quick, otherwise they'd get very badly burnt by the sun. In fact, the normal precautions that are taken in the British Army when you take troops to a hot climate.
You said that when you arrived at Haifa, your first impressions were rather favourable.
Yes. I think what I really meant was, certainly from the point of view of a young chap aged 20, arriving in a foreign country with a warm climate and the sun which apparently shone all the time, and the complete strangeness of the people and their language, it was so very different from England that I think it rather impressed us. After a bit, perhaps we didn't like some of the aspects of the climate and the hot winds that blew and all that sort of thing. But at first, we were very favourably impressed, particularly with the lovely sea bathing, because we went straight from Haifa off the boat down to a place called Netanya, where there was an army camp within a few hundred yards of the sea, and only a small Jewish village, as it was then, about half a mile away or a mile away, and you could take your platoon first thing in the morning before breakfast on a run for physical training down to the beach, have a quick bathe for 10 minutes, put on your clothes and run back through the orange groves, And the Jews didn't mind. We'd each grab an orange on our way and eat it as we ran. And it was, we were very impressed with the climate and the sort of facilities, till perhaps we started going out on our columns into the hills, which again in its own way was terribly interesting. And after all, what does one join the army for? To be a soldier, and if you're going out in strange lands and exerting oneself, and at the same time trying to remember what one's been taught at wherever it may be, Sandhurst, of how to compete in this sort of terrain, that is what one has presumed to join the army for.
What was the purpose of you staying, first of all, at this camp at Netanya?
Well, that was our base. The whole battalion was based, its headquarters, and whoever wasn't out in what we called an outstation was based at Netanya. And indeed, for a few days, we were all there. Then, as far as I remember, one company, that is about, say, a fifth of the battalion, was sent to a place called Nablus, and based there in an old Turkish fort in Nablus. And then a second company went to a place called Jenin, which was about 30 miles, I suppose, north of there, on a railway line and on the edge of the plain of Esdraelon, where the mountains or the hills come down to the plain. And a third company was based at Tulkarm, which was again at the foot of the hills, 10 miles away from Netanya, in a straight line. And so that really meant that there was only one rifle company left in Netanya, with the headquarter company, which was the administrative company. And that fourth company was on call all the time. That if an extra company was needed to go and do some particular job, then it was called for and it rushed off in lorries with its mules for carrying any heavy equipment, and went into the hills, either in support of one of the three companies from Nablus, Jenin, or Tulkarm, or simply on its own. And so that if you were stationed in Netanya, you were either one of the administrators, or you belonged to this this company, which was at fairly rapid call, that is to say that it had to be able to get out of barracks, I think, in an hour from the time it got its warning. Sometimes you were brought to a rather shorter form of readiness of a quarter of an hour or something like that. Similarly, the companies in Nablus, Tulkarm, and Jenin, they would have probably one of their platoons, which is approximately a third of the company, at short notice to go out and do any immediate job. But as a rule, platoons didn't go out on their own. It was usually on a company basis. And say, if the Nablus detachment was sent out, usually the whole of the company, except for a small rear party, enough to actually guard the barracks, went out. So you could say that the battalion formed, or could form, four columns, which could be self-contained.
And you yourself stayed at Netanya for how long?
Well, I only stayed in Netanya for a relatively short time, because I went out with B Company, as it was, and we were stationed in Tulkarm, and Then later we swapped with the company in Nablus. You always move people around, so they got a bit of a change. And I spent most of my time out in one of the detachments. I did have a turn, actually, with the company, which was in Nathania. But even a lot of the time that I was with them, we were out in the hills. So we didn't really have much time for playing around. Those three Arab towns which I've mentioned, Nablus, Jenin, and Tulkarem, at that particular time, they were known as the Triangle of Terror, because a great deal of the terrorism which had happened in 1936 and now is beginning to happen again took place roughly within the area of very rugged, hilly country which is enclosed between those three towns.
What kind of acts were these?
Well, they would ambush, not usually convoys, because we had convoy systems running once the ambushing got bad, but they would particularly try to ambush, say, two or three vehicles. They would do acts of sabotage. They'd pull down telephone lines or telegraph poles, and they would dig up roads. And the particular thing that we disliked most of all was that somebody had taught them how to lay mines. And this was the nastiest thing that happened. Somehow, one didn't mind being shot at, but one didn't like having mines put in the roads. They also made a dead set at, say, police posts. They reckoned that police posts were an easier target, and they used to shoot them up, and very occasionally they managed to get into police posts and steal their rifles. But those are the sort of incidents which were going on.
How many casualties did your unit take?
Going on my memory, I think we only had, during the 18 months or so we were there, we had about 8 people killed and probably about 30 or 40 wounded, that sort of thing. Not as much as one might think, but there may have been more wounded. There were quite a lot of people sort of slightly wounded from bullet splash or from bits of rock flying around because they'd been hit by a bullet. But the Arab marksmen were not terribly good, and they usually fired from fairly long range. The whole difficulty, really, with these operations was to bring the rebels to battle. Because very sensibly, when they saw that they were outnumbered by a fairly sort of well-organized force like a company column, they would melt away. They'd hide their rifles under rocks and things and get into the nearest village, where they would be the first people to appear with cups of coffee for us. And we realized this, and we used to joke with them up to a point, so far as one could, either through the interpreter or through one of our officers who might be able to speak Arabic. And we'd sort of say to a chap, where did you leave your rifle, as a matter of fact, before you gave us this coffee? And the chap would roar with laughter, but you knew that very often that what you'd said had a certain amount of truth about it. There was a certain element of what you might call gentlemanly warfare, rather like, I believe, that used to exist on the Northwest Frontier, where my father served for 28 years, and he used to tell me much the same sort of thing happened with the Pathans. But this was the whole trouble, to try and bring them to battle, and this led quite often to you adopting tactics which tried to, what you might call, put out a bit of bait. And let the Arab rebels think that here were so half a dozen British soldiers wandering around in the hills, and here's a nice, easy target. And once you got them to shoot at these chaps, and you had the rest of your force hidden somewhere within reasonable reach, then you had a reasonable chance of inflicting a certain number of losses on the Arab. But usually, the great difficulty was to bring them to battle. And for the first several months while we were there, one of our troubles was to try to keep the vigilance of our soldiers up, as we'd begun to teach them. Now look here, we're going out, and any moment we may be fired at, so you've got to keep vigilant, keep on the alert, watch out, remember what you've been taught, and your tactics and your section training and all that sort of thing. And as the first month or two went by, nothing happened. And the soldiers obviously were beginning to wonder whether we hadn't been telling them stories or not. And then they were woken up with a vengeance, because we did walk into a bit of an ambush where the opposition, partly the opposition made a mistake and partly we made a mistake. They thought we were much fewer than we were, and we hadn't even been expecting anything. We were just going to go to sit in a village called Umm al-Fahm, the mother of charcoal, it means in Arabic, and we had two chaps killed. And after that, the soldiers in the battalion realized that there but for the grace of God am I. And it sharpened everybody's susceptibilities. And after that, everybody were much better soldiers. It's rather a pity that one has to sacrifice lives to achieve this object, but this so often happens. It was much the same before the Dunkirk campaign. We used to teach our soldiers that they must dig slit trenches to be reasonably safe from the dive bombers, but they didn't really believe us until they started being dive bombed. After that, you couldn't stop them digging. Same sort of thing.
How did the morale of the men stand up to taking the first casualties?
Well, astonishingly well. I myself was very agreeably surprised by the fact that the reaction of the soldiers was rather not so much one of revenge, because they realized that this was a reasonably fair fair combat. It was more or less rifle to rifle, but they then realized we've got to be better, we've got to be much more vigilant, we've got to move up these hills quicker than we've been doing. It certainly didn't have any bad effects. In fact, it really had good effect. I mean, I suppose if we'd had very, very heavy casualties, then obviously it might have had effects another way. But it was sufficient casualties to put us well on our guard and on our mettle.